Hello, listeners, and welcome to the AfriWeta podcast, where we look to celebrate African history, people, and culture by telling our story. As always, our hope is that it fills you with enough curiosity to go and do your own deeper research. Karibuni to any new listeners to the AfriWeta world. We invite you to check out previous AfriWeta episodes, which can be found on this podcast platform. Thank you so much for tuning in. Today, we're headed to Central Africa to meet the Kuba Kingdom. A shout out to my Central Africans out there. AfriWeta has landed on your shores. I apologize in advance for the mispronunciation of words that will most definitely happen. But before we begin, please remember to visit us on our socials. Our handle is at AfriWeta on Twitter and Instagram and all the other social platforms, where we do post interesting facts, stories, updates, and links for further study for all you lovely people. And please, please, please remember to tell your friends and families about us. But for now, let's just sit back and enjoy the journey. So the Kuba were a very proud and powerful civilization, and we shall understand why as we go through this episode. The kingdom itself was a conglomerate of about 18 states with different groupings. The most well-known of them are the Bushongo, who were the most dominant, having held the ruling titles throughout the history of the kingdom. This collective or federation of people saw their star rise in the 17th and 18th centuries, and it got to hit its own heights in the mid-19th century. This is also around the same period as their contemporary Central African civilizations like the Luba and the Lunda. AfriWeta covered them in season 1, episodes 11 and 13, respectively, so please go check them out. The Kuba arrived as conquerors to the region, absorbing and adopting the culture of the indigenous Twa. They also held tight to their own history from as far back as the 5th century AD. Over 100 dynastic families kept alive by oral traditions. This heritage was maintained by formally appointed historians who were charged with this very important task. So by now, you have your maps out, right? So let's go and check out where we are on the African continent today. So the kingdom was in what is modern day South Central Democratic Republic of Congo, which is the DRC. Its borders were mainly defined the west by the Kasai River. The Sankuru River was the northern border, and the Lualaba River defined the southern border. Now that we know where we are, let's have a look at the origins. So there are a number of versions of the folklore story of the origin of the Kuba Kingdom, all of which were genuinely pretty cool. But for you, our AfriWeta, I will share a version that is pulled together using the common threads across all of them. Cool? So the version is around Bumba, the first ancestor. He and the Earth Mother had three children. So, and I'm going to butcher this, Nyonyengana, Chongan, and Chedi Bumba. Bumba himself, the first ancestor, had reign over the earth. But at that time, all that was there was water and darkness. Then one day, he started to vomit. Yes, you heard me right, vomit. And I really honestly tried to find any other ways to say this, but the story across all the variations, vomit. But this is no ordinary vomit that came out of his mouth. In fact, to start with, what came out was the cosmos. So we're talking about the sun, the moon, the planets, the stars. And then these then brought light to the earth. And then with the sun dried up the water in parts, leading to the land emerging. Now that there was land, Bumba started to vomits up the first animals. There was a leopard representing the land creatures who would roam the lands, and the first bird, an eagle, which represented all the air creatures. He then proceeded to, vomit more animals, including a crocodile, a fish, a tortoise, a heron, a beetle, and a goat. And then lastly, humans. So, after this, these animals and birds went on to, you guessed it, vomit up other animals and birds that were similar to them. So what this meant is, for example, the heron made other birds, the goat all the hoofed and horned animals, the croc all the serpents, the fish, the beetle all the insects, and these in turn made other creatures, and so on and so forth. So now, while all this was going on, Bumba charged his children to finish up the job that he had started. So it's said that Nyonye Ngana didn't last and died whilst creating the white ants. Chongana vomited a planet that, sorry, not a planet, a plant that all plants and trees stem from. Yes, pun intended. And lastly, Chedi Bumba created another bird, the hawk. So when all was said and done, the animals and birds, the flora and fauna were given to humans to rule over. And it is here that we hear of Wut. The relevance? Well, the Kuba refer to themselves as the children of Wut. So very quickly, some versions of the origin story say that Wut was the first ancestor and that this is his story, basically the story of Bumba. Some other versions state that Wut and his sister were the first, and that others, and other versions still, that Wut was the son of Labam, who was the daughter of one of the first men, Lakian, the chief of all men. So there's many other versions, but I hope that our family, our Kuba fam, could share their versions with us at AfriWatu so that we can share it with AfriWatu. Hit us up on our socials. So when it comes to the facts, the more recent history Kuba story starts with Mishe Mishiang Mabul, otherwise known as the Great. He and his royal clan migrated from up north, crossed the river Sankuru, and conquered the local inhabitants they found there. He and his Bushong people then established the foundation of the Kuba kingdom back in circa AD 1613. So there are also two versions of his own origin story. One was that he was of noble lineage, being the adopted son of one of the queens, and then he decided to head out and create his legacy. The other version is that he was the son of a slave Bushong woman. The similarity in the stories is that he was the one who left his home and took with him a whole community that included the best warriors, which kind of makes sense if you're going into the unknown. He then went on to conquer lands and then garnered knowledge from his extensive travels that lasted at least 2 years. And it was at the end of this journey that they arrived at what we know as the Kuba lands. When he and his people got there, the lands were ruled by Mishanga Matumba, who claimed to be a descendant in that line of Wut. Mishiang usurped him, and in AD 1630, he ushered in the best years of the Kuba kingdom. He was said to be a very wise ruler, and having been very well traveled, he adopted some of the things he had seen that had worked in other civilizations and connected his people to the long-distance trade routes he had links to. His era brought in new ideas, advanced technology in terms of tools that impacted the economy. He also helped set up the social structures, brought in new political systems like a more centralized governance system to manage the existing and fast-growing multicultural conglomerate of different ethnicities and principalities that was the Kuba Kingdom. Mishiang's legacy lives on till this day. He is celebrated as a great magician, a great medicine man, and of course, a great leader. And he is really held in very high esteem by the Kuba. And seeing as we're already speaking about the most significant ruler of this kingdom, this is a good place to jump into the next section about rulers. Cool? So the Kuba society is matrilineal, from the highest in society right to the lower levels. In the highest position in the land, the Nim, which is the name for the Kuba king, this was reflected in how he was selected. So although it was clear on the matrilineal part, the intricacies of how this worked in practice were not that straightforward, and the succession process could be a tad problematic at times. The Nim candidate, with the backing of the Queen Mother, was presented to the Crown Council that was made up of the 18 clan leaders and representatives, and also representatives of the Bushong. The Nim was considered the supreme leader, lawmaker, greatest warrior, and having absolute and divine authority. His supernatural powers were seen to act as the bridge between the two worlds, having been granted this power by Chembe, the Kuba deity. Actually, so revered was Anim that he was always in an elevated position, and I kid you not, never sat on the ground. So let's take a quick trip. We walk into the Kuba capital of Nsheng. And our guard takes us toward the royal palace. We look around and marvel at the precise layout of horizontal lines that is a key architectural design known to be from the Kuba, and that the capital city is known for. Our guard points out the yurt up ahead, which he tells us is the Nim's residence, and the dwengi where his wives reside. He then tells us that the inauguration ceremony that we have come to attend will be starting soon, so we must hurry. So as we keep walking, our guide fills us in on the background of the ceremony we're about to attend. He starts. Our great Nim ancestor, Mi Xiang, revolutionized our systems. He brought new cultures from across the lands and rivers. One of these was making the capital city the hub, and he required that all the nobility and significant offices of the state were to operate from here. It is he who truly developed our royal court etiquette and customs and introduced the concept that Nims were rulers by divine right. So, this being the seat of power, whenever a new Nim is being installed, the different clan heads have to come and pledge their allegiance. Now, we're here. Let me take you to your space. So as we creep in and we walk and look around, we see the most beautiful woven mats and cloths, the famed Kuba cloths made of raffia with all sorts of patterns, decorations, and colors. As we settle in, our guide points out the new Nim, seated up front with selected members of his family behind him. We notice an intricate wooden statue. Actually, there are two of them. Our guide sees that we've noticed them and decides to educate us. Ah, I see you have seen one of our beautiful symbols of power and culture rolled into one. Those are called jobs. One belongs to the new Nim and the other to the departed Nim. The Njop is a representative of the Nim, immortalized. Even its design reflects the power and the supreme nature of the Nim. So, for example, see how the Nim does not sit on the ground? The Njop also sits on the base, not touching the ground. And if you look even closer at that base, you will see very artistic and complex design patterns reflecting his high and royal status. When the ceremony is over, the Ndop of the deceased Nim will then be returned to his throne room / grave. Back at the ceremony, we look on and we see that the clan heads, each of them in possession of their clan symbols and pledging their allegiance. As we look around at the dignitaries gathered. We see the array of gorgeous and stylish royal costumes, which look like they've all been stitched and designed with painstaking skill. Each one very distinct and tells of the wearer's status. The Neem's articles and clothing are, of course, a cut above the rest. And as an aside, our guide has informed us that battles have been rumored to start because of copying or appropriating any regalia, like for real. And then speaking of articles and royal regalia, we see the famed Dun Bushong belt, the belt of the Bushong. It's a heavy belt made of bark, and the Neem's is covered in cowrie shells. In addition to this, we see that for this particular ceremony, a special drum, two horns that date back to the land's history, and a gong are on display. The Neem himself is holding a sword in his right hand and a spear in his left. All this while, where there have been tributes pouring in, and the clan heads, as is the custom, have also been offering a wife to the new Neem, each of them. The oral historians have been giving an account of the Kuba history, weaving the wonders of the olden days and past kings and queens through song and poetry. And they are supported by the noble women who have lent their voices to create the oral history being told like no other. And as the final ceremonial part of the inauguration goes on, we've been told that we have an invite to stay on for the festivities, think like after party. We have even been given appropriate clothes so that we can blend in properly. I think we shall stay a while and enjoy the party. The festivities are really just about to kick in, so let's just do that, yeah? I mean, it's too soon to go back home. I hope you all enjoyed that epic party. So now we know the setup of the royals, let us step into how the kingdom was governed in a very practical sense. So let's start with the basics. The Neem was always from the Bushong's people, and he and the central government sat in the capital city of Nsheng. The Kuba government was centered around a system where titles and favor was granted to those who were loyal to the crown. These loyal subjects would then be bestowed with the power and influence from their positions. The different polities within the Kuba, although having political autonomy, paid a tribute to the central government's Bushong's royal court, and each had a representative within the court. These polities had 18 reserved titles, the Kolm, which is K-O-L-M, and the rest were given to the royal subjects of the Neem. The Neem, although considered supreme, was bound by the constitution. He had to consider the views of the nobility and court officials, which included women, who in this kingdom, by the way, were held in very high regard. There was a council of elders, an integral part of the Kuba governance. It was here that key decisions were made for the kingdom. The queen mother held a revered place in this council, yielding a great deal of power and influence, so the Neem always looked to have her support. There was a clear separation of powers, and the key actors in the Kuba administration, which was run by appointed officials, they managed key areas of government from the judiciary to the military to administration and so on and so forth. The government also had within it further levels of responsibility in the management of the police force and the military. There were specific roles, such as that of the prime minister, who could actually act on his king's behalf in weighty matters, such as in the judiciary. They were able to act as Supreme Court judges. They also adjudicated over the usual crimes such as theft, murder, sorcery, damage to property, divorce, or martial issues. Actually, now that we have happened on the judiciary, let's scratch the surface a little bit. So these courts followed mandated procedures and processes that were also split into different levels, from the clan, to the village, to the chiefdom, to the kingdom courts. And the case at hand would be taken in front of the most appropriate court. If after the verdict, which was usually where there was a fine or restitution of sorts would be the judgment, If after that one was still dissatisfied, there was an escalation process from the lower to the higher courts. The cases that were considered petty disputes were heard in the more informal moot court, with public hearings and adjudicated by fellow kingsmen. On the extreme end, if it was a murder case, then it jumped all the levels and went straight up to the higher courts. So when a case was brought forward, like if we're taking it from the beginning, and those ones not dealing with murder, but everything else, the claimant would then have to pay to have their case heard. Their matter, once assessed, would be taken to the relevant and qualified court and the judges convened for the hearing. There was also the option of having a trial by jury. If, after the judgment, either side was not satisfied, then, as I said before, an appeal process was present. So you could appeal to take it to the next level up, which was in front of a bang, which was a comte, so a noble title holder. If still not satisfied here, then the next level up was the one headed by the kikam, a sort of like a high court. If all else failed, then the last and final court was the Supreme Court, where your case was put in front of the nobility, as well as even possibly the nyim. So kind of a pretty straightforward process. Then when we come back to the other governance systems, the Kuba had a powerful nobility and officers who were quite influential in the council bodies. Take, for example, the very powerful Ishami. These guys had the power to veto the Nim's decisions. The Nim himself would then either have to accept their decision or he himself send the matter to the next council up, the Bokilam, whose role was actually not usually to overturn the decision, but instead try and find a middle ground, you know, a compromise. Other important roles included the provincial officers who administered the kingdom's provinces, the head of the treasury who managed the treasury, collected gifts and tributes. And then, as in most, if not all, powerful civilizations, there was a strong military, one of the largest armies in the region. So obviously there needed to be a representative in the governance structure. And this was done by the commander-in-chief, who was considered the sixth most powerful person in the kingdom. He was also involved in the judiciary, presiding over court cases. He controlled a formidable army, one that subdued all the conquered people through their chiefs, and they would have to then submit annual tribute to the Nyim. The governance system found in the capital was actually replicated across the provinces, and they were led by the head chiefs. The posts themselves were not hereditary, and the Nyim could actually appoint the successors or replacements of these chiefs at their discretion, but many times it was seen that they would take into account the public's preference. So, let's have a step into the society. The Kuba, as we said before, were matrilineal. And this is how the social structure was set up. Matrilineal social groupings were the basis of clans and villages. Each grouping was led by a clan chief and his council. Because the Kuba were not one homogenous group of people and were a collective, it meant that they had a rich culture that was as a result of the fusion of all the different groupings within. This included civilizations such as the Luba, the Pende, the Mongol peoples, for instance. The values espoused by the Kuba in general included dignity and poise in everything. But this does not mean boring and grey. But in our own indomitable African way, the Kuba did so with color and pomp. It was a very artistic culture, and celebration of this was seen in all aspects. Quick aside, as has been said in previous AfriWetu episodes, culture is not just about art, or indeed calling all things of African crafts and work art, but also understanding the cultural significance. We shall examine these concepts in relation to the Kuba in a little bit more detail a bit later. But back to society, the Kuba placed a high value on works and skills of those who used wood, metal, cloth from the days of Mishang, who introduced advanced working ways and how to manipulate different materials. Because the aristocracy were known to compete for pole position and recognition, and one of the ways that they used to do this was through the elaborate dress worn and displayed by both men and women. So really, as a result, artisans were greatly valued in society and called on to do loads of commissioned work. For men, to show their social standing, a common practice was the embellishment of the raffia caps and hats, with blue and white being the more popular colors as they denoted leadership and piety. When it came to the designs, these would indicate his role. So if he had gone through an initiation into manhood, his status, his achievements, his level of accomplishments and rank in society through the beading, the ornaments, which would include feathers, metal, shells, furs, patterned applique, bead and cowrie shells. Dressing up was not just about looking good and showing your status to one's peers, but it also lent to being noticed by the royal family and the powers that be, in the hopes that they could, upon being viewed favorably, be elevated in society by the name of the day. Remember, titles were not hereditary. Now, I found a few interesting tidbits which kind of act as a bridge to the next part as we start to wind down on the society section. So let's have a briefest of looks at the religion of the Kuba. So one element was how history was passed down from one generation to the next in terms of religion and society. We heard the origin story of how the world came about. Remember the one where he was vomiting? That one. I don't think we need to repeat it here, right? Anyway, these Kuba, who are also called the children of wood, in their religion placed the Nim as a spiritual leader and labeled him the Ngesh, or nature spirit. He was seen to be the unifying factor for the different Kuba peoples and clans. It is said that the eldest son was entrusted with the history and knowledge of the people by the woman who held the highest status in the court. She was considered not only wise, but also a diviner who entrusted her knowledge to this eldest son. What was passed down included how the people are not only to behave in society and remember their past, but also instructions are given on how to worship and appease the deities and, where necessary, correct the mistakes of their past. Another interesting fact around religious ceremonies was the one about how the Kuba buried their dead. So what happens is, the body of the one who died was covered in a number of different layers of textiles during the actual ceremony. They were then placed in a specially designed coffin that reflected the typical Kuba house. And then they were sent off with various items that they would need in the afterlife before lowering them into the grave. After this, depending on how the deceased lived their lives, they would either be rewarded and become an ancestor spirit before rebirth, or be in limbo forever as a punishment for your evil deeds. So having met the people, let's dash across to the next section about their culture and art. Now, this was something that was of significance across all levels of Kuba society, so local artisans did not lack to find patrons for their work. There are so many examples of their artistry and skill, but because of our limited time, we shall only touch on a few. Cool? The nobility played a big role in the culture space, as they were patrons and commissioned the artists being the weavers, the blacksmiths, the leather and cloth tailors, the wood sculptors, and so on, to make items, cloths, articles that was suitable for their status or for an occasion. Even in the royal courts, they found footing and audience with the Nimes, who would commission specially made drums with design patterns that would act as royal emblems for the king of the day. Other created items ranged from very well adorned caps to ornately molded and carved drinking vessels with interesting designs, such as those that merged human and animal likeness and such like. These vessels and other articles were then used or displayed to show the level of wealth and prosperity of the owners. Fun fact, earlier we visited the inauguration ceremony of the king, remember the party? And if you remember, we saw the job, albeit very briefly. So each king would have a sculptor create one that was unique to them, and because it was representing his soul. Then Njop was used to represent him when any woman in his harem was giving birth, to act as a protector for there to be a safe delivery of the child. Then Njop was big in size, and each had the ruler's ibol, which is a personal symbol that represented the king, placed in front of it. We'll make sure we put a picture so that this makes sense. But one famous Njop is that said to be of Misham, whose ibol, remember the founder, whose ibol is the Mankala board. This is a game that he's said to have introduced to the Kuba to represent his intelligence, knowledge, and strategic thinking. As an aside, it is also said that he was the one who introduced the Njop and the whole concept of the Njop to the Kuba. On the king's death, the Njop is part of the initiation ceremony for the next king. And at the ceremony, the Njop is said to transfer the late king's power to the successor. And once done, it is then taken to the room with the predecessor thrown in it, the one next to his grave. The next two articles are the most famous of the Kuba mask and the Kuba cloth. So with the Kuba mask, it is one of the most significant cultural symbols, and they are truly a sight to behold. The masks hark back to the time of the ancients. The oldest one is the Mbum mask. Remember Mbum, the first ancestor? They were made from wood, animal skins, feathers, beads, with many different types of designs, colors, and patterns. The king had their own special masks that represented kings, the Mwash Ambui. Masks played an important role in the ceremonies, and each ceremony had its own uniquely styled mask. These ceremonies included initiations, inaugurations, funerals, and festivals. Then we come to one of the most coolest things about the Kuba culture, and that is a famous Kuba cloth. This cloth is woven from the raffia palm leaves, and it is not a simple process. It takes days for the transformation into just one placement of cloth. The tradition of the special Kuba cloth and the tapestry, the weaving and patterns, is something that spans centuries and is handed down from one generation to the next. The Kuba splits the role of cloth weaving. The men, by and large, carry out the cultivation of the palm leaves, the stripping, drying, applying color dyes, and then softening the leaves' fibers. They're also the ones who then carried out the weaving of the cloth using their special looms, which were the inclined heddle loom, I believe that's what they're called. They then beat and knead to soften the cloth some more to get a really smooth felt-like feel once completed. This is then at the point when it's handed over to the women, who then transformed the cloth into the different styles, like a tribute cloth, baskets, skirts, sleeping mats, house mats, headdresses, and so on and so forth. They would also add, you know, the flair. So through design, the applique, the embroidery, the beads, the cowrie shells, etc. The cloth's patterns had symbolic significance. These patterns number in the hundreds, each one with its own name. Some were named after the creator of the pattern, others by the clan, others still named for those who commissioned the work. The patterns encompassed all permutations of geometric possibilities and variations, each family, clan, grouping having their own distinct style. They told a story of the person, about their status in society, family history, it could be a family heirloom, marital status, who their clan was, and so on and so forth. On top of all this, the Kuba cloth could also be used at special ceremonies, sometimes as weddings as part of the dowry, but it was also found at births, funerals, and festivals. The cloth was used as currency and even sometimes to settle legal disputes. And now that we mentioned currency, let's nicely slide into the next section of trade and economy, but very quickly. So for the next two sections, trade and economy and the demise, we shall have a really, 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 really short and super summarized version, because we have genuinely run out of time, okay? So we have already seen one of the major exports and goods of the Kuba, the cloth. The other creative skills of these people is seen in their manipulation of iron, brass, copper, in making various weaponry such as swords, knives, and so on. They were also skilled with woodworks. The Kuba were into agriculture, and this seemed to be more for local consumption than for trade, growing bananas, millet, sorghum, tobacco, groundnuts, beans, and maize. The people were very well versed with hunting and fishing as main activities, the latter especially having the Kasai River just there. Then when it came to trade, the Kuba used to trade in Kuba cloth, copper, beads, indentured people. The currency was the cloth, cowries, and other types of selected shells. It was a big player and did well out of trade, becoming a very wealthy kingdom, despite being known for being closed, a closed society to foreigners. In fact, it was by pain of death to allow any foreigner past the border market towns. One of the first to be allowed access was a Black American missionary, William Shepherd, who was only granted access in AD 1892 because the king of the day stated that he was probably a descendant of the Kuba. And now the demise. And you know what I'm going to say, right? What happened? Well, let's start internally. There were many issues within the kingdom during the rule of the time of Mbop-a-Balik-Mabul. He was struggling to quash the constant rebellions that the different groupings threatened. There was also great tension overall created by a civil war. This had been triggered when the successor he had chosen was technically not the next in line. I mean, already drama, yes? Well, the rightful heir was not going to take that lying down, and ergo, war broke out between the two factions. But despite all of this, in the end, the rightful heir died in AD 1983. But even with this, and so the situation was, you could say, kind of resolved, the war had only exposed the cracks that, and it was almost open season on the kings, a number being killed, external parties and foreigners lending their support to preferred rulers. It was genuinely just a disaster. And as if that wasn't enough, you know, it was further exacerbated by the European foreigners who were messing about with the region's politics, leading to all manner of chaos, anarchy, revolts, which then led to the Nyim being imprisoned. When the king was eventually freed, he immediately set about reclaiming his kingdom. But honestly, by all accounts, it was still the end of the kingdom, as by AD 1910, it had ceased to have its own independent identity socially, having been broken up irreparably. So what was going on in this time? So in 1644 to 1674, the Mauritanian 30-year war. In about 1645, the Ottoman War with Venice. In 1776, the Illuminati was founded. In 1778, Vietnam is reunified for the first time in 200 years by the Thay Song brothers. In 1779, the Xhosa Wars, I know I said that wrong, between British and Boer settlers and the Xhosas in the South African Republic. And in 1789, we had the French Revolution. So as we bring it home, the Kuba Kingdom, just to put it into context, has been acknowledged as one that was on par with Imperial Japan, Augustan Rome, and such like. But we, Afriwatu, know that its real peers in terms of African excellence can be found right here on our continent. This was such a rich cultural civilization. So Afriwatu, I do hope that that came out and you really gelled with it. In fact, one little tidbit is that in terms of how rich this culture was and the influence it has, it is said that modern Cubism, as well as the various arts that have been done by Matisse and Picasso, was highly influenced by the Kuba arts, and in fact is alluded to in the works by these master artists. So you can only imagine. I mean, that's just one little tidbit. So as you gel with it and you just think about it, please remember that this is just the first stitch in a rich pattern of the Kuba cloth. Yes, yes, I know I can hear the groans, but I just had to. I couldn't help it. And as we close, Afriwatu, again, my mind was blown away when doing the research on this kingdom. It always amazes me how dope our ancestors were each and every time. And then it's such a great feeling when, you know, we step into the past to really understand who we are today and then also be able to chart our own futures for tomorrow. I wanted to close with a paraphrase quote from the founder of the Kuba Kingdom when he spoke of his job. "When they look at this statue," he said, "they will be able to remember me and think I am looking at them, consoling them when they are sad, and giving them inspiration and new courage." And with that, until next time, Mubarikiwe. Oh,